Hello and welcome to the Underwater Technology Podcast from SUT, the Society for Underwater Technology. My name's Steve Hall, I'm the CEO, and each week we're bringing you interviews with our members, friends and guests from across the broad international world of underwater technology. Podcast 31, 15th of October 2020, and my guest today is Luke Alden, and he's from International Submarine Engineering in the west coast of Canada.
My name is Luke Alden. I'm an Englishman living in Canada, in the sunny BC, though as I look out the window, it's very grey right now. I started my career, as it were, doing a product design degree in the south coast of England. So a very general degree on anything from theoretical physics to design for manufacture to drawing fancy concept sketches. So not very specific at all. And then from there, I went into aerospace design. I designed control panels and buttons and switches for aircraft, which was a lot of fun. And then I ended up working for the RNLI, the Royal National Lifeboat Institute in the UK. I was helping them design watertight doors. And then me and my partner decided to go on an adventure into Canada. So we moved here about 7 years ago and did various different things before I found out basically that International Submarine Engineering existed here and they've been doing amazing things for 45 years. So I applied and started working here. And it's been a great ride.
Oh, it's a fantastic company, Luke. And those of us who've been working in the, particularly working in the world of marine autonomous systems, often think of ISC as the pioneer, particularly, I suppose, because of the work of the Theseus vehicle in the back in the 90s, the under ice work that it was doing. And our regular listeners will have heard the podcast featuring Bruce Butler a few weeks ago, where he spoke specifically about the Theseus mission. But of course, things have moved on. Theseus, I believe, still exists. Is it still at the factory, Luke?
It is. Yeah, it's quite a pleasure seeing it every day. It's got some character, signatures all over the fiber optic dispensing tubes. Oh, sorry, they're the variable ballast tubes. Mm-hmm. So it's good to see that. And there's a few places where it got dinged along the way, as I'm sure is in Bruce's book. So it's always interesting hearing those stories and lots of lessons learned that obviously were carried forward into the design of the next AUV.
Yeah, yes. So, so whilst sort of Theseus in many ways might be the sort of granddad of all of the larger AUVs that many other nations and companies have developed over the years, ISC has, of course, gone on from strength to strength. So tell us a little bit about the history of the company and the kind of products that it's come up with.
Well, the history of ISC is very diverse. It's one of the things that I enjoy about going in every day is there's photographs on the wall that are 45 years old. And the company kind of started with Jim McFarlane and Al Trice coming from HEICO. They made manned submersibles there to kind of improve the safety of all the commercial divers, which a lot of Al's stories, unfortunately, end with various friends of his not making it in various scary situations underwater. And then they wanted to make it even safer. So they started doing ROVs. So that was where ISC started. And they built over 200 ROVs in the life of the company. And they've all done various different things, like mine countermeasures to giant ones that are big as a van, that do trenching operations and have various different capabilities. And the focus of the company really from Jim was "get her done" is his phrase. And he just liked to make cool stuff. So almost every ROV was designed to solve a problem. It wasn't here's a product we make and try and use it. It was someone would come along and say, we need to do this subsea, and ISC would just work out how to do it. And that branched into various different places. Like, we did some work on the Canada Space Arm. We did a huge project for Shell to autonomously refuel people's cars, which in the end, I don't think they decided what they wanted to make commercial, but you know, we got it working.
Okay, I didn't know you'd done that. Carry on.
Yeah, so obviously the Theseus project was a big one, as you mentioned. And for those who don't know, it was sending a giant 12-meter vehicle under 180 kilometers of sea ice in the Arctic. And that was a fairly long development cycle and taught us a lot about obstacle avoidance and risk mitigation and, a lot, basically. And that was back in 95. And then we took the good parts of that and built what we call the Explorer Class AUV, which we've so far made 16 of. And again, these have a similar approach to the ROVs. They're designed to be problem solvers. So typically it's a customer will come to us and they've maybe got a new sensor they want to integrate and a new problem they need to solve with it. And we'll solve that problem with almost a custom AEV for them each time based on the same architecture.
Tell me more about the Explorer.
Yeah, okay. So again, those that don't know what the Explorer looks like, it's a very typical AEV shape, basically a long cylinder. Ours are typically 29 inches diameter and about 7 meters long. But one of the beauties of it is it's modular, so you can actually switch out payload sections, which can increase the length. And these also have modular battery sections. So the standard one is 24 hours, but you can actually add in up to 3 battery sections to triple the endurance. And that gives it about a range of 400 kilometers and can give you an endurance of about 75 hours. And we've actually just finished our first 6,000 meter capable one. And the standard issue is 3,000 meters. And that gives you a weight of up to about 3,000 kilograms. And it's a big thing. So we can make sure that it captures good data, has the best sensors on there to do good survey work.
Yeah. And as you say, it is quite a large vehicle and quite heavy, particularly if you've opted for one with the extended range. So does it require a particular kind of deployment and recovery system, or are you able to use the standard crane or A-frame that you find on a host vessel?
Well, we'd always recommend that you get a properly designed launch and recovery system. And that's often a difficult sell to the customer when they're already investing a lot of money into an asset like this. But the most dangerous time with these assets is bringing them on board a ship. So we have customers that lift them out of the water with the crane, but they operate in very calm seas. Also, we have our own ramp-based LARS, so Stinger system, that hangs off of the freeboard of the ship into the water so that you can recover up the ramp. That's our typical one, though because we are passionate about it, we've got a crane-based LARS system we're developing and even a autonomous docking solution, which would eventually lead to launch and recovery.
So Luke, the big problem for a lot of marine autonomous systems is, of course, onboard power. And whilst a surface vehicle might be able to use solar panels, or I've seen at least one that had a mini wind turbine on it. And in fact, there are even some designs that actually use small diesel motors, which we might not always associate with autonomous systems, but they certainly work. But we don't have those luxuries with the ones that spend their time underwater. So Can you tell me a little bit about what the power source is at the moment and how you're planning to innovate the in terms of recharging in the near future?
Yeah, well, we currently use lithium batteries. We've periodically do a battery study where we look at all of the technologies out there and the energy density and kind of cost benefit, etc. So we found that this one gives you a lot of bang for your buck, as it were. And one of the things that we really focus on as well is survey efficiency, or how to make sure your asset pays you back quickly. So obviously, when you have an expensive asset like that, you want to be surveying all the time. You don't want to be spending a long time recovering it. You don't want to spend a long time recharging it. So we've actually got a fast charge system. So it allows you to charge the batteries in 3 hours. And that's regardless of whether you've got one battery bank or three. And obviously that allows you to get, you know, straight back in the water. And unfortunately these days, because some of the sensors take up so much data, you can sometimes recharge the batteries before you can even download the data. But you know, that's a different problem. And in that vein, with the autonomous system that we're designing, we're kind of leveraging previous experience in underwater charging to basically install a connector. So this is all in a view to do the persistent maritime surveillance effort. We've had a lot of experience in that. We've written studies for DRDC here in Canada about you know, the best ways to approach this, you know, considering various different goals that they're after. And in this case, the impetus was because they're to surveil with an AEV, you'll typically have a streamer, which would be up to 200 meters long that is being towed by the AEV. And you don't want to stop that. So our autonomous system is based off of an ASV towing a towed dock system that the AEV will track, home in on, and dock with. And then it has connectors inboard that allows it to charge the system. So it's got enough copper in the connector to charge quickly, and then you can download the data, and you've got a satellite link on the ASV, and then it can call home, send data home, and be retasked from there.
Okay. And can you give some examples of the typical kind of missions that the customers for the Explorer are using it for?
Well, like I said, we typically design them to be kind of configurable and modular. We've got a couple of companies that kind of exclusively use them for survey. So they kind of get them to a state where they, you know, have lots of checklists and procedures and make sure that every time they put it in the water and do the same things, they get the same results. And it's very good at that. It's the way that we set up everything means it collects IHO survey data. So it can be used for surveying and get you highly accurate results. But then we have a lot of universities that use it, and they love the giant payload space in both the pressure hull and in the physical AEV as well, to just try anything. So we've had mass spectrometers put on our AEVs. We've had companies putting different systems to try and get cathode protection, like sensors. So I'm specifically thinking of OFG. They have an ICP sensor, which has the ability to check the cathodic protection on a pipeline from afar. So the idea being you can just pilot the AEV along the pipeline and it'll tell you how the anodes are doing.
Okay. And are you able to give some examples of who some of your customers have been, or are they, or is all that sort of data in confidence?
I know what I can definitely say. We've sold a few into Japan. There was definitely an appetite to monitor underwater volcanoes out there and look into various different seafloor geophysics and all sorts of interesting supermassive sulfides on the ocean floor. They're interested in seeing what their country has. And then there's a couple in Europe as well. University of Bremen, Infomir has them. There's some in China, Memorial University on the east coast of Canada. And then there's also University of Southern Mississippi that has one of our vehicles too. Peter King in Tasmania.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And of course, the Tasmanian vehicle, I suppose it's true to its DNA, has been used for Antarctic missions, hasn't it?
Yes, yeah. I don't know why I missed that off the list, really, because I still see that as our most exciting work. So we built this AV for Peter King and with the view for it to go to Antarctica. And we even sent one of the team on the first visit to Sourcedale. And I just loved the presentation he did when we got back, showing all the penguins getting in the way of everything and coming in to investigate. And the challenges that we have to kind of foresee when you're going under ice are definitely more than if you were just surveying under deep water. And we also know a lot about that because of the two vehicles that we built for NRCan in Canada, where they went up to the Arctic and they surveyed under ice for about 11 days. So we put a hole in the ice and dropped them into the water there. And they would go off and I think they did 1,100 kilometer missions over those 11 days each time. Homing themselves back to the ice hole and being charged underwater again and then, sent off again.
Yeah. And so when a customer buys one of your vehicles, I presume they buy rather than lease, but when they do buy one of them, you mentioned earlier you've got a decent amount of payload space fore and aft in the vehicle. Do you leave that empty for them to put their own configuration of instruments in, or is it always sold as a sort of a pre-packaged deal?
Well, the base vehicle that we always present, it comes with an INS that's linked with a DVL with a sound velocity sensor to make sure that the nav is correct. And then we basically have a shopping list that we send to them. Say, what extra features do you want above that? Do you want extra range? Do you need a specific depth? Are there any extra payloads that you need us to integrate? And typically, every build we've done has required a new integration of a new sensor. So we've done SAS, we've done side-scan sonar, multi-beam, sub-bottom profiler, CTD, customer-supplied acoustic modems, cameras, magnetometers. So yeah, the list really goes on. And for us, that's not a challenge to integrate those new sensors. And for some customers, they want to play with it and add their own systems. So typically the universities will send more foam than they need so that they can float new sensors that they want to add that they don't even know what they want yet. So, we'll leave a big payload space for them to do that.
Okay. And how do you train the users? Do you send one of your technical staff along when a vehicle is delivered, or do they typically send their people over to the west coast of Canada to learn the ropes back at the factory?
Well, it's a good question. Obviously, now it's a lot more complicated. But here in the west coast of Canada, we've got a beautiful fjord named Indian Arm, where we love to do all our sea trials. It's a really sheltered, calm bay, but it's still got some fairly deep water. And we know the terrain very well, so we can prove the OAS works in a non-risky way. And ideally, we'd bring the customer out there. So we've got our own research ship that they can... they can be on. It's got a classroom there, so we can explain the operations of the day and show them how the mission planning works, what to look out for, and that's typically like a 5-day training for whoever they want to send, essentially. But over the years, we've done anything. We've gone there, done it, you know, remotely. Some customers are determined that they don't want any training, which is always scary to us with such a complex machine. So, yeah.
Yeah. And are all the machines that have been delivered still out there? Does the number of returns equal the number of launchings?
That's our motto, basically, when we're at sea trials. As long as the launches equal the recoveries, it's been a good day. But yes, in answer to your question, we have several out there that are 15 years old or even more. Some of them. The Memorial one came in recently for an upgrade. We upgraded its whole system to a new Linux system and GUI and gave a lot of extra bells and whistles. Mm-hmm. One of the AEVs from Japan came back recently and had a camera installed and fast charge upgrade, and some of the sensors got a new upgrade as well. So, yeah, it's one of our focuses is to make sure the investment never goes out of date.
And when vehicles come back, especially the older ones, the ones that have been in service for a long time, typically is there anything that's particularly, you know, not working, or anything that you notice wears more than anything else, or are they coming back in pretty good condition?
Well, we typically do a yearly maintenance cycle on them. And, you know, there's always gremlins in the machine. But, you know, a lot of our actuators and a lot of the devices that we've built. And for most of those, it's because when we started, no one was doing it. So we had to design it and build it ourselves. The design is mature. So we know all the gremlins that might happen, and we've been able to kind of really tweak the design to make them robust. You know, you'll always see something that you weren't expecting. It's a complex machine. You can't expect nothing to go wrong.
Yeah, it's good. And you mentioned earlier that part of your sort of career history had been designing, cockpit interfaces, instrumentation interfaces for aircraft. With the ISC Explorer series, does the operator have a sort of a standardized interface to, program the machine or tell it where its waypoints are? Now, what has been the approach at ISC? Do you have a kind of a standard user experience? And related to that, do your users tend to simulate the missions first, or do they put it in the water and wait and see what happens?
Well, again, that really depends on the operator. Mimosa seems to be our standard mission planning software. But ultimately, the Explorer, again, we've designed it to be quite open in that respect, kind of trying to be both hardware and software agnostic in as much as possible. So our mission file is human readable. So it's really easy to kind of QC it and also easy to integrate it with various different mission planning software. And we have our ACE system, our automated control engine, that is common across all of our robots, as you put it. So, yeah, it'd be the same control system for our ROVs as well. So at least when you get something from us, you know that how it's going to work and the
okay, it's consistent across the range. So, you know, somebody yeah. who's used to using ISC hardware will find a similar interface, whether it's an ROV or an AUV. Yeah,
exactly. And we also we've got a backseat driver as well. So I know Mun's been recently playing with that. They've developing their own systems to hunt for things like oil in the water column. So again, that's an effort from us to try and standardize how you control the vehicle. So we still keep the vehicle safe with our control system, and then we give you the option to change the mission parameters during the mission.
I guess one of my questions would be, has it found a home with any defense sector users?
Yeah, it's a good question. We've definitely had interest, Jim McFarlane, he was in the Navy, so he definitely had a keen interest in that, and a lot of our ROVs, as well as our semi-submersibles for mine countermeasures, definitely been used for that. But we've just not seen huge interest in the AUVs for that yet.
So we've seen the Explorer develop now over a period of some 15 years or so. It's a mature design. It's got a very good reputation as a reliable AUV. So where next? Is the vehicle line going to continue, or are you moving into a new generation of products? Now what's ISC hoping to do in the near future?
So there's a couple of incremental gains that we're still looking for. For example, launch and recovery, it's still something that we feel needs to be improved. So we've got, I was mentioning the crane-based LARS. That's designed so that you can use any crane of opportunity, and you have a fairly low-cost system that you can install. So that's been a big push, and just trying to solve the problems of how do you connect to the AUV when the ship moves differently to the AUV when it's on the surface. Try and minimize the kind of risks there. But also, we are due to upgrade the entire system, kind of take the lessons we've learned, and essentially see what happens when we start again to rethink the framework and improve the functionality to really give you the long range. Although we've been able to do 6,000 meter AUVs for a while, we haven't had many customers coming to us actually needing that. But more and more recently, they not only want to go down that deep, but they want to do real science. They don't want to just send it down with one sensor. So that requires a larger diameter vehicle, basically, to get the efficiency that we expect from our vehicles. So bare minimum, the new Explorer, has yet to be named, would be a larger diameter vehicle, a lot more range capable, probably a new battery technology or new energy technology, I should say. Nothing's off the table as of yet. And yeah, the plan is to go into that design cycle any day now, and just have to watch this space to see what we come up with.
Okay. And ISC, as we've said, they're well known for these quite large science focused AUVs like the Explorer class. Are there any plans to make a smaller category of vehicle, more like your Remus size systems as well, for users who don't need the same level of capability?
That's a good question. I mean, I would love to have a portable small AV out there. There's nothing stopping us. We've already have designs for smaller pressure housings that can house our vehicle control computer. It's just a case of piecing all those pieces together. It's just a case of us deciding whether we want to enter that market. And I know a lot of the big players in the smaller AUVs have been bought up by various defense companies. So maybe there's a space for us to bring out a really configurable, adaptable, smaller AUV.
Excellent. And ISC is a company that strikes me as an outsider as almost a family in many ways. Is that an accurate way to describe it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's always been Jim's baby. The camaraderie is one of the reasons I go into work every day. They're great people to work with that have great experience. I mean, I've only been here for 3.5 years, but a lot of the people have been here since it started. So, like for example, the CEO and COO, they've both been there for many years, and kind of seen the company grow, and the likes of John Mark, who kind of saw an advert about what ISC does and just kind of got on the next plane from the East Coast of Canada and didn't leave.
Luke, we've heard a lot about ISC's leading role in the supply of, you know, professional large scale AUVs, but are there still other products in the portfolio?
Oh, of course. Obviously, we talked about ROVs already, but we also make semi-submersibles. So some of those have been used by the Canadian Navy. So that those were kind of ahead of their time. And although they are, you know, amazing machines, for those who aren't aware, they're basically an AUV-shaped vehicle that has a snorkel. And it sits just below the waves, so about 3 hull diameters is what we kind of, our analysis showed us would be the depth we needed to get to kind of allow the vehicle to cut through any waves. And it's a diesel-powered huge vehicle that allows you to tow a system underneath it. So that was paired with our Towfish towed system that had a big Klein sonar. But again, it's adjustable. You can it's had multi-beam on it. It can have side scan on it. It can have basically the same sensors the AUV can. And then this is an autonomous surface vessel, essentially, with a towed system beneath it that has a lot of control to keep its depth from the ocean floor and you know, be used for mine countermeasures, which is great. You can send it out in front of the fleet to do that. Or it can just be used for just surveillance to aid the fleet. And this giant vehicle can actually go up to 15 knots in the water. And again, like, doesn't care about the waves because it's below them.
So yes. I remember seeing one some years ago. I think it might have even been taken to the National Oceanography Centre on a display at one of the trade shows down there. And it's a spectacular beast. As you say, it's quite large and, of course, very impressive, particularly looking at the video of it in heavy sea conditions. And what do you market it under the name of?
That vehicle's Dorado, and it's got its smaller brothers that are dolphins. And, we call them semi-submersibles. They're essentially autonomous surface vessels.
And are you still making the ROVs as well, or has it been a little while?
Yeah, it's been a little while, but yeah, definitely we still have the same capability as always. Obviously, with the downturn of the oil price, the market is kind of flooded with day use ROVs. People don't need to own their own equipment when they can rent a fully staffed team for pennies on the dollar. So we haven't had as much interest in them. So our focus has been AUVs for the last few years, at least whilst I've been here.
Great. Okay. Now, if somebody wants to find out a little bit more about ISC or if they need to get in touch, how do they do that?
Well, our website has a load of information. So it's best to go there probably. So that's just 3 W's. .isc.bc.ca. It's also got other information about in some of the manned submersibles and other projects we've done there if you want to find out about them. But then if you have any specific questions, you can email me as well. So my email is luke.alden@isc.bc.ca.
Okay. Well, it's been really, really good talking to you. We look forward to seeing what ISC brings to the community in the future. For those who aren't already aware, SUT is beginning to establish a presence in Canada. We have an embryonic branch happily developing in St. John's, Newfoundland at the moment, and hopefully in time the SUT influence will continue spreading west until we're over there in British Columbia as well. So it's been a delight talking to you today, Luke. Good luck with the future, and we'll keep in touch. Thanks very much.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Stephen.
My thanks to Luke for telling us about International Submarine Engineering and their products. really interesting to hear what they're up to, and a company we can look forward to some really exciting products from in future. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. My thanks to Emily Boddy for creating the podcast artwork and composing and performing the podcast theme music. Don't forget that we'd like to do a Christmas special where we're responding to your questions. Email us at steve.hall@sut.org or emily.boddy@sut.org to make sure we've got your questions. Find out more about SUT at www.sut.org. We'll be back again next week with another guest. Until then, stay healthy, stay safe, and we look forward to speaking to you soon.